Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Well, it's the three questions again. You know, it's what America, it's basically what's keeping America holding on, is me asking the three questions of different people. And today, I am lucky enough to have a very funny, very, very talented man, Demi Adejuyibe. And did I say it right?
You did. Nailed it.
Oh, thank you.
I was even oh, wait, we forgot to do the thing where you're like, how do you say it? And then you got it.
I did that much research. I mean, that was really all I knew about you. I'm surprised that you're black, basically. That's
yeah, most people are like, Adejuyibe. Could have
That's sworn. Irish, right?
Yeah. They're confused my lack of red hair.
That name has it's tough here. Isn't it to have that, you know?
It's people do that like very performative, like, oh God, how do I? And I'm like, you don't have to just get through it. I don't know.
Yeah.
But aside from that, it's like a conversation piece for most of everyone else. It's just sort of like, Nigerian, huh? Oh, I know someone who went to Kenya. And I'm like, okay, what do I do with that?
Now, were you born in Nigeria?
No, I was born in London.
In London? Oh, wow. And how long? And you were there. Oh, that's right. And you were there for just a short while, right?
I was there until I was four. We moved here just after my sister was born. And then my family moved to Texas.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
From London to Texas. Wow.
Yeah. Very similar places.
Yes. Did you have a cute little English accent when you were little?
I did. And I lost it when I was six. And I'm pissed.
Oh, really? You could have been so classy.
Oh, where my career would be right now if I still had that English accent.
Right. You would be, you know, probably in Star Wars or something.
I would. That's the only thing keeping me out of Star Wars. Got to be a British guy.
Yeah. Well, what was, were your folks at school in London? I mean, what was the, why the trajectory Nigeria, England, L.A., Texas, L.A.?
I believe that they went to college in Nigeria and then got jobs in England. But I also think that I really should know this, but my dad was born in England and had family in England, so it was easy for them to live in England when they did.
Oh, because he had citizenship or something?
Yeah.
I see. And do you remember England? Do you remember much?
Not in terms of my childhood, but we used to go back every so often, and that's what I remember. And I was there most recently a year ago. But before that, it was every other summer, we'd just be like, all right, well, let's go back to England and see our family. The memories of that time are still very fleeting. I remember areas and things that we would do, or just being like, oh, okay, my cousin and I are going to go walk in this weird bog type area, but I don't remember England as a whole.
One of the local bogs. They have bogs everywhere.
I mean, bogs there are like McDonald's over here.
So then how was Texas? I mean, was that a culture shock? What was the transition like? And you say you came here first. Did you come to LA for very long in between England and Texas?
Oh, no, sorry. I meant I don't even know why I phrased it like that. No, I didn't come to LA until like I graduated college.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it was from England to Texas?
England to Texas to LA.
Yeah. And where in Texas?
Dallas. And Plano Dallas. Specifically, if you know it.
I do know. I do. It's yeah. where the
heroin Cowboy capital Stadium. Of the world.
Is that where Cowboy Stadium is, or is that Arlington?
Oh no, that's Arlington.
Oh, okay. Wait, it's the cowboy capital of the world? Is
it was the heroin capital of the world? Oh, for heroin. In the 90s.
Why? Why Plano, Texas?
There was like there was a time where like I think like 8 different like white kids overdosed on heroin, and then it became a thing where they're like, we have to stop this epidemic in the town, and then they like cleaned it up.
Oh.
But it was very much like a rich kids got. Like had a minor opioid crisis and it became like national news, and they were like Plano is the heroin capital of the world, and then I came in and I was like, stop it, and they were like, all right.
I thought maybe that like it became the heroin capital when you showed up.
No, yeah. No, and any timeline that says that is wrong.
I was a 5-year-old heroin kingpin.
Don't ask where my wealth comes from.
Well, I'm looking at your place. It's very palatial.
Well, no.
So Dallas is all right. I guess, you know.
Dallas is all right. I always feel like when I talk about Dallas, I say that it doesn't have too much culture to it. And that's what makes me feel like I don't miss it at all. Because
yeah.
It feels like growing up in Plano is a very suburban place. Like the standout thing to do was like, I guess I'll go to the mall.
Yeah.
And outside of that, it's like when I go to Dallas, it was just for like a concert or some event there that I would then look around and just be like, I don't feel like this place has anything that I can like glob to. It's like, well, this is why people love Dallas, which is weird because it's like Austin. I definitely feel like I went to college in Austin. I felt instantly like this is a town that I would love to be in as a town.
Yes.
And like Houston is the same way, where it's like there's so much culture there and things to do, and like people from Houston are very proud of Houston. But Dallas, I'm just sort of like, it's just this place.
Yeah.
It's not really a place that people live as much as a place that people go to.
Yeah, yeah. I always well, I had an aunt that lived there, and then I did one of the first things I did. And it kind of bridged when I left the Conan show in 2000. I shot a movie there. I worked on a movie there. And the people, like, and it really did strike me going back as an adult, like, there's really not a lot to do there besides malls and restaurants.
Yep.
And then it just seems like it's banks. It's like places to put money, spend money, and get fat. And
it very much is. I feel like Dallas as a whole is just sort of like, it's wanting to be Wall Street, but not really putting in the effort. So it's just sort of like, let's get a bank in there. What if we had the Dr. Pepper bottling offices down there? Like, what if we had all of these things? It's like, oh, sure, you guys can work down there, but what else is there to do?
Yeah,
where
yeah.
you go when work is done.
Yeah. Yeah, it feels very financial there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I know somebody that worked on the movie, and I was sort of in and out. I didn't stay for long periods, but the people that were there for like three to 4 months. And I think they figured out the average weight gain was like 11 pounds of the entire crew, just because it's, you know, barbecue and Tex-Mex, Well, now was it a hard transition coming into Plano, Texas from?
I don't feel like it was. I came here and like went to kindergarten, I recall, but then also had like daycare in between that. And so it felt like my biggest thing wasn't like the culture shock as much as it was just like, okay, there are two different sort of transitions I need to make here of like groups that I'm seeing, and there's very little overlap between them. But I don't feel like I think I was so young that it's just sort of like every kid's like, what do I do tomorrow? And so the shock is just existing more than it is like, oh, I got to exist in an American way now.
Yeah.
But I also feel like I don't remember a lot of that time aside from like little moments here and there where I'm like, oh, I remember this because it was shameful, or I remember this because it was like super notable.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
And, Were you always like a funny kid? and also a musical kid. You're very musical. And I mean, were you playing music a lot when you were a kid?
No, it's actually very funny. I don't have any musical training and have never really, like, the closest thing I got was in fourth grade, I would during lunchtime, instead of like going to eat lunch, I would just sort of go to the music room and like try to teach myself songs on the piano. And that was like the closest I got to being like musical. And then it was, my parents were like, well, do you want to take lessons? I was like, no, that sounds like too much work. But we got like a Casio keyboard that I would mess with every so often. And aside from that, it was like, I never really did anything musical. I played through middle school. I played the euphonium in the school band, but even then I was like, I don't care that much about this. I'm going to stop as soon as I can. So it's weird that a lot of the things I do now are very musical, but I think it's sort of like, it comes from this place of really liking to tinker and really just feeling like, oh, if there's an idea that I have, at least music is a very like formulaic and like mathematical thing where it's like, I can sort of figure it out if I need to. And I don't have to like have like a knowledge of theory. I can just sort of go like, well, I guess it sounds right. And this note does sound right coming after this. And then I can just do that for a long enough time. That's like, well, now you have a song. But yeah, it feels like I should have at some point gone like, I'm doing this a lot. Maybe I'll formally learn how to make music the right way. And I never did.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So can you read music or sort of? No, really?
No, yeah. I mean, I took like music classes as a kid, the ones that they make everyone do. Where it's like, all right, we're going to sing Hot Cross Buns today and we're going to teach you how to read music. But I immediately forgot it. And like, I can't read sheet music or really play piano that well. It's like I can sort of like hear a song and then go like, okay, well, if that's this key and it's like I can learn the muscle memory of how to play specific things, but I don't know what notes I'm playing.
Wow. That's still pretty fucking great. I mean, yeah, I'd love to be able to pick out, you know, a song on the piano or something. And I see a guitar behind you. Do you play guitar a little too? Or
yeah, that's the thing, is like I have a lot of instruments that I have just picked up being like, I want to learn to play that. And oh, an instrument's very cheap. Sure, I can play that. And I play guitar because it's really just like you can learn specific chords and then kind of make it up from there. And it's not as it seems easier than piano to me because you can just sort of like there's not as many combinations for notes to me. And then it's like individual notes sound so much better on a guitar than they do on a piano. But then I also recently in quarantine have been like, I want to learn to play this violin that I bought once as a bit ages ago. So I've been playing a lot of violin. And that's also fun and a lot less difficult than I thought, but it's still like, I'm just hearing sounds and going, okay, I'm going to try and make that sound. And I'm like, I do not know what note this is. And it's very frustrating to be like, I think I've got the sound right. And then just go like, all right, well, what am I playing? It's like, I don't know. I don't know where the C is on the keyboard. I don't know what note this is. It's just mimicking. I'm just mimicking things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you do fine. I mean, because so much of what people know you for are the musical bits, you know.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, and some of them you're just sort of rapping to a track, right? Or you're sort of, you know, like the September thing. That's just, you don't, there's no music in that other than the song, is there? I can't.
No, there's I will edit the song to be a joke in itself, but there's no like, there's no me having to perform it, really.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, what did you go to college for? I mean, did you go, what were you studying?
I went to college for film. I went to UT, and I was just sort of like, I wasn't a musical kid, but I was a very, like, in the same way that I like tinkering with music, I was always just like, I want to do something with film and video and would, like, make very, like, low-budget commercials for competitions with friends, and I was like, I want to figure out how to do this professionally. And then I went to college being like, all right, I'm gonna figure out what in film I really like to do. And so I did that for a while and was like, oh, TV writing is stable, I'm into that. And then I sort of like was like, okay, I want to write for TV, but I also really like, anytime they gave us like a project deadline, I was like, I can work with a deadline, I can make something, and I can actually just like I feel like motivation was always my the hardest thing for me. So just going to college and having them go, you have to make a short film in 2 weeks. I would get excited and go like, I can do this because I have to do this. And therefore yeah. it's like, oh, I'm going to finally make a thing that I've wanted to make. So that was nice.
When did you start feeling like, you know, that, because I always feel like there's, you know, outside of LA, I don't think there's a lot of parents who are going like, you know, who are encouraging their kids that like, yeah, you can be in show business. Yeah, you can do right. that. It's a, there's always kind of, I feel like a certain level of hubris built in to when you're young and going like, I'm going to be in show business. And I mean,
totally.
Your folks, you know, in Plano, Texas, I imagine you're not getting a lot of exposure to show business.
No, not at all. I didn't even like, weirdly enough, I didn't get into movies or like see a lot of movies as a kid. So it wasn't until I was an adult that I was like, I really like movies. But it was like my parents weren't necessarily encouraging me to do it because they were like, well, do computer science. That's very stable. And I had friends that were like, oh, it's going to be a really hard thing for you to do. But I was still just sort of like, I don't think I'd be happy doing a lot of other things. So I'm going to try and do this. And if I fail, then I have so much time to do something else. And I can like minor in computer science or whatnot. But I was always sort of like, this is the thing that even now it feels like people are seeing from me that they feel like, well, that's notable. And I'm like, well, if I have like a step up now, then I can sort of just keep just like learning things along the way. And it's not going to be like a thing where I'm going in with no experience and I have to suddenly become like, great. It's like okay, I'm pretty good at this thing right now. Maybe I can just slowly become better and better. And people just go like, oh, he's not there, but he's doing good. And I think that's like just the idea that it wasn't me starting from zero and just one day out of the blue saying I want to do movies was something that I was like, well, that means it's not as unrealistic as I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Were your folks like open to you kind of finding your way, or are they kind of more traditional and wanted, you know?
They were very traditional and wanted me to like do something that they could just be like, okay, well, this, we know we won't have to worry about him like having like a stable life or even a stable income when he does this. But I think they sort of recognized that they kind of couldn't stop me from doing it at a certain point and were like, all right, do the thing, but we're worried about you. And I think over time they became less worried and now are sort of like, well, they're still worried. They still will text me and just be like, oh, are you okay financially? And I'm like, yes, I'm fine. And they're like, but you're not working. It's like, yeah, but you don't work sometimes in LA and that's
yeah,
fine.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do think that it like took some coming to terms with for them, for sure. Because it's not like there's no, even if like they did believe in me, I think they would have just had like to come to terms with the fact that like there's no day where you're like, okay, he's made it, or like, oh, he's at the point where he's like good now, because that's just not how jobs work in this industry. So I think they were always just sort of like, people really flop out of that. How are you not going to do computer science instead?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's, it's expecting a lot to expect parents to understand.
Sure.
You know, I mean, because my, you know, even after I was on television for a while and then left the Conan show and was, you know, had a TV show on the air, my folks would be like, well, what happens if it gets canceled? I'm like, well, I don't know.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, do you have anything lined up? I'm like, no, I don't, you know, and they're just like, what? How do you live like that? You know?
Right. Yeah. Every time I have a writing job, my parents are just sort of like, oh, it's only 20 weeks, but what happens afterwards? I'm like, I don't know. I look for another one. And they're like, but then that one's done. It's a very terrifying industry to work in or to have a child working in, because it's just like guaranteed, time off, essentially. Yeah. Just being like, they're gonna have to try again.
Yeah, and you have to get used to like just insecurity and the unknown, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, and it is, you know, there are times when it just doesn't happen for a while, and then when you really fucking start shitting yourself. I mean, not literally.
Unless that's what pays.
Yeah, it is. Well, we're, you know, it's COVID times. A lot of webcam work, things like that. So how is the transition to college for you? I mean, first of all, I mean, it is, like you said, Austin is, like I once said that Austin is like sitting next to a fun gay cousin at a Romney wedding, at a like Mitt Romney family wedding, because yeah. It's like you're in the middle of Texas and you get this feeling that like, wow, what a cool artistic, you know, town with, you know, it's pretty integrated and there's a lot of gay people and there's a lot of weirdos. And then it's like, yeah, but it's like a little island, you know, in the middle of a pretty conservative place.
I think that culture is starting to shift in Texas, so that's not the case, but I do think it's like a very slow shift, and like going to Austin was the best. It was, it's the same thing as when a lot of people go to college and just sort of suddenly find themselves exposed to like different types of people and cultures that they weren't exposed to in their tiny town, but it's just like the entire city is like that, and it felt so open and like loving and embracing of all sorts of different like weird things, and it felt like the perfect place to go to college and then feel like you're an adult. And like it was a festival town as well, so you just felt like it's nonstop like things to do and like people to see and hang out with, and it ruled. I love Austin.
Yeah.
I worry sometimes that like it's like I don't think now I'm like, oh, would I ever go and live in Austin if I didn't have to live in LA? And it's like, maybe, but I feel like so much of my love for that city is a love of what it was because of the people I knew there. And like a lot of those people have moved on now. So it's just like, oh, I guess maybe it's not the same to be there now, but it's just such a special city to me. And the transition to like from Dallas to Austin was, at first it was just like, oh, like I applied to a bunch of colleges and UT was the one that I got in for film and not computer science that was also in-state. So I was like, well, it's in-state, so the tuition's cheaper and it's a really good school. So I was able to convince my parents to be like, yeah, go to UT. And I got lucky that the city itself was so welcoming and just like a perfect environment for me, because I didn't feel like there was this sharp turn of like, ah, who am I here? It's just like, I don't know. It just felt very easy to be an adult and like just find who I was and like not be like, I'm from Texas, and have that be like, oh, what does that mean? Who do you really identify as, a Texan? It's like, well, no, but I do feel a lot closer to Austin as my personality. You've been to Austin, yeah. Right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And I had family there for a while. So I went there for, I had in-laws that lived there and we used to go visit a lot. It's ridiculous. It's great. It's like,
great.
It's such a nice town. I mean, it's too crowded now. I mean, you know, it's obviously like a smaller city that way too many people have moved to because it's so cool. And now the roads, you know, I mean, when my in-laws lived there, they were just like the traffic. And it did seem like it was just.
Oh, even when I was down there, like it's one of those cities where it becomes like a sort of cultural saying of like, stop moving here. And it's just like, I very quickly became one of the people like, yeah, stop moving here, as if I hadn't also just moved there for school. But it does feel like a thing where you like, you start to love the city and you get why people are moving there. But you're also like, well, it's our thing. You can't, no more people are, like, the door is shut.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you start, what kind of work were you doing creatively in school? Were you doing just basically classwork, or were you part of any groups or anything, or?
It was mostly just classwork. In high school, I had done a bunch of stuff with friends where we, like, there were online websites where it's, like, you submit creative briefs to basically go like, I want to make a commercial for this company. And it's like, if you win, you get $2,000. And we were like, that's $1 million to a child. Yeah. So I would do a lot of those. And then when I got to college, I didn't have time to do those as much, but I still was like, I want to make things as often as I can. And that's when like Vine and Twitter sort of popped up for me. And I was like, oh, a little video platform where my friends and I can like shoot a dumb idea in a like an hour. And that's where I feel like so much of my creative energy went in that time. Because I wasn't really doing much of anything like extracurricular wise at that time that was related to filmmaking or writing. Every so often there would be like a film club or like a filmmaking club that popped up on Canvas or on campus. But I always felt like, oh, it's at the most inconvenient time or place and I just can't get to it. Or I would get intimidated because everyone there seemed to know much more about movies than I did. Because it was like, I hadn't seen any movies until I got to college. And then they would like show us movie and I was always, duh, The Matrix, huh? But like, it felt so alienating to me at the time that I was like, I'm just going to figure out my own thing that I can do without feeling like I have to be a film person with like a capital F.
Or know every single Kubrick movie and all that.
Exactly.
I went to film school too, and there does – and I mean, even to this day, there's people that are – that for them being – well, I mean, there's so many people about every sort of specialty that like – their knowledge of the thing gets used as like a cudgel, you know, just to like beat other people up and
totally
assert some authority. Yeah. And I definitely felt that in film school too, where people would talk about, you know, they talk about, you know, like I say, like Kubrick movies. I can't remember the.
They're just like film movements or being like, oh, just talk about it in like a theory or media way. And
yeah,
I was
always
just sort of like, I don't know, man. I like this movie. I don't like this movie. I don't know these movies. And it felt very much like, even though we were all in school together, it felt like there's this thing of like, you know, and like, if you know more, you care more and you're more of an authority. And I was just sort of like, I don't know anything. I can't do this then. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and also too, it's like, A lot of these classic movies that people talk about are kind of boring.
They're so boring. Yeah, and it's like a lot of like theory attached to it or just being like, well, this is historically important because of this. I'm like, okay, but is it fun?
Yeah.
And a lot of the times the answer is like, no, but.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I started 2 years at University of Illinois and then I went to film school in Chicago at Columbia College. And while I was at U of I and preparing to go to film school, I took a couple of film courses. And one of them, I was a sophomore, and I think it might have been a senior level course of film theory that I was able to take. And it was like, let's look at films from a semiotic point of view, which is like, I even to this day, I'm like, I know that semiotics is the study of symbols, but I don't know what the fuck that means. It's like,
yeah, I don't,
you know, in this, you know, a table can become an altar. Like that, I just remember that being an example. Like, okay, but I don't know how you can watch a whole movie and, you know, and look at it from that point.
Yeah.
And I realized, like, in this class, and I was lost in this class, like, this is a language that people learn to speak just to each other, like film criticism. It just seems to be like, it doesn't have any relevance really on a lot of the people making movies. I mean, some of them I think are very, you know, they're getting their heads about it, but I think most, you know,
it feels like this thing where like the people who do use this when they're making movies use it in a very specific way that, again, unless like you have people reading into it that way after the movie is done, you just kind of are like, well, then why include that at all if it's something that you have to like study up on to even understand? Yeah. And then I'm like, okay, well, I'd rather just make a movie where like the point is very clear. And it's like I had an ex who used to always say that like writing, you're not writing to sound smart or like use big words that are alienating to your audience. Cause then it's like, why are you writing at all if you don't want people to understand it? And it's like, why are you making films that are like purposefully, obtuse and like don't have, meanings that can be understood by the most people or like by the audience that you're making it for? If you have to like do research to understand your movie, it's like, then you're making a movie weird. I don't know.
Yeah. You write a book.
Yeah.
You know, books are for smart people. Movies are for dumb people. They
book
should know
smart,
that.
Movie dumb,
movies
TV
dumb,
dumb but have dumb. More time.
Yeah. Dumb, but easier.
Yeah.
Because you're home.
Looking for some amazing TV to stream? Indulge yourself with the hits on Hulu you can't miss. Dive in with Barney, Ted, Robin, and the gang on How I Met Your Mother. All 9 seasons are now streaming on Hulu. Then you can move to Modern Family, Schitt's Creek, and My Wife and Kids. We're talking every episode and every season of these shows. We're talking huge hits, streaming on Hulu whenever you're in the mood. Now we're talking.
Want to make Mom's Day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat Mom to the good stuff from just $30.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
Now, is it in college, like, that you start to kind of get some traction online with Twitter? Or, and, I mean, was Vine probably the first place that you kind of really started to be known outside of just, like, your regular circle of friends?
I think it was Twitter at first, for sure. And then Vine came in, like, I want to say my sophomore year of college. And it was just this fun thing that, like, I could both do, like, little mini sketches, for lack of a better word, but then also just post weird videos of my friends. And I liked that it was like, I can do either of these things. In the same way that people on Twitter were like, I can write jokes, or I can just be like, I had a pizza for lunch today. And it's like, well, you can't get mad at both of them. So I just loved that. And it was like, it was so fun to just have a thing that I was like I had friends where it was like, they weren't all in for film, but we all like enjoyed making vines and would like love to do that together. And I loved that about it, that it didn't feel like this very insular group of people who are like, we got to think about this in a film theory way. It's like, no, we just want to make a thing. And that sort of got big in a way that I didn't expect. And then it was like, when I moved to LA, I was still doing vines, but with people who were definitely more about like either all in on Vine or all in on film in some way. And I was like, okay, this is fun, but it's a little different. But yeah, I think Vine was the first place where it was like, or not, again, Twitter was like where it started. And like, I think Twitter and Vine together sort of like rose my profile in a way that were where people were like, oh, this guy's doing interesting stuff online.
What is that like? I mean, because I came to Twitter as a known quantity, and I mean, right. And Twitter is pretty much all I do. But you're starting out as a college kid, posting Joe, and you're Electro Lemon, for people who don't know, and right. You just start posting jokes, and it just starts to grow. I mean, how does that feel, and what do you think when you're a kid doing that?
It's weird, but it's also sort of like, I don't know. I think that I've always had I think I developed a sense of humor as like a defense mechanism when I was very young. So it's always been a thing that I've been like, okay, I think I'm funny and creative and can do this kind of stuff well. So like doing it on Twitter was just sort of more validation of that idea that it's like, oh, okay, I can still do this. And I am very good at like figuring out what works in certain contexts and then being like, okay, here's how a joke works here. Cool. I can work with that and make a joke that works especially well, knowing the like universe around this area, or like this sort of like ecosystem of Twitter and Vine. And I think that it was both like, it's fun because my brain is comfortable in this space, and it's nice because I am getting credit for doing a thing that I think I'm good at. But then it also became this thing where just sort of like, there's a certain point at which it was like, oh, people start to see me as like, a person or like a personality. And I'm like, oh, that's weird. I don't want to be seen as someone that's like special or different from, like just people think of me as like, I guess it started to feel like when people thought of me, they were like, oh, well, Demi's like a Twitter personality. And like, they would say like Twitter personality or Vine personality in a way that made me think like, oh, okay. They think that I think that I'm better than like a normal person or whatever. And that's when I was like, oh, no, I don't want to do this anymore. Where it's like the impression of me becomes a reflection of what they think I think of myself based on what other people think of me. And then I'm like, oh, I don't like that at all. That was always the hard part of it. Just like sort of feeling like the way that people sort of like talk to me about me or even just talk about me, make it seem like I think I'm special or like better than people. And I'm like, no, I'm really like, I'm in college. This is a fun thing for me to do that exercises the muscles that I came to college to exercise. And there's nothing more to it than that. And now even I'm like, I had ideas for musical things and I put them on the internet and then I just kind of go on about my day doing nothing else. I don't know.
Yeah. And people pass them around. Yeah.
Yeah.
But when you start to get a follower count though, I mean, is there ever any kind of, does it cause like sort of grandiose thoughts like, oh shit, I'm on my way. You know, like I have, I imagine you started to get like a fairly, I mean, you're a follower count while you're in college and then your vines are being watched kind of, you know, the way popular vines got watched while you're still in college.
I think the thing that kept me from ever feeling like that was just understanding the ecosystem of both Twitter and Vine and recognizing like, there are so many people with big follower counts that aren't getting like anything or are like only that way because of a certain thing. Like Vine was like, all right, if you are a pretty white teen, you're going to have like a million followers and you're going to have all these deals and whatnot. And I was just kind of like, all right, so there's not going to be a number at which people start like knocking down my door to be like, you're going to be the next big thing, kid. And I would like have friends who were popular on Vine and still seem to be like doing the same thing I was. And I was like, okay, well then this isn't going to be like this is always just going to be a thing where it's like, if someone finds you and thinks that you're good, then maybe you'll get to do something else. But it's not like, there's a meter for when you hit this certain level, you're going to be great. And so it was like, I never tried to follow the follower count or like any sort of number to be like, oh, I'm about to hit the big time, even though there were times where I had like one joke or like one vine that would be pretty popular. I would go like, oh, that's pretty cool. Or like I would see certain people like interact with it. And I was like, okay, that does rule. But it was never like, all right, any second now, I'm going to get a message from Hollywood being like, all right, it's time to do the next thing. You've hit the big time.
Yeah.
But I think also just, it was hard to have that idea in my head and then also not, because there are times where I was just like, all right, well, I'm putting a lot of work into Vine. I feel like that should help me elsewhere, but it never did. And therefore I would just like not really put in a lot of work to do things elsewhere because I was like, well, I'm spending all of my creative energy in this one place. I can't really go and try to make a short film or something else like that.
Yeah.
Because so it was just like, it's hard to both be aware that the follower count and like all of these things doesn't mean anything and to not think, well, I'm putting in all this work. They have to notice that I'm good eventually.
Yeah. It also, I think it's so immediate. Making a short film takes for fucking ever.
Yeah.
Costs a ton of money.
Be seen by no one.
Yeah, it could be seen by no one. Whereas you can like fuck around with your friends in an afternoon and something can get seen by tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people, you know?
Totally. But it's like there are tens of thousands of people doing that. So it's like the ecosystem is flooded.
There's also no payoff. I mean, you don't make any money at it. And it's nice and it's great. But I always, There is, I was, you know, you make things like that and you feel like somebody's making money on this. Like it's being watched so many times. I just feel like, and I don't know who's monetizing, and I guess, you know, Vine is monetizing it somehow, but it always, that would be the hard thing for me, having not grown up in an internet age or come of age in an internet age, where I'm kind of used to, like, I mean, we did improv shows, but like, right, if I was going to just make short videos, it would feel like, well, yeah, but I mean, people make videos for a living, and that's what I want to do for a living. And it just seems, you know, although when you're in college, did people around school know that you had a, you know, like, yeah, it was like, hey, there goes that Vine guy. He's a Vine star, you know?
I hope it wasn't like that, but there were times where it'd be like, oh, I meet someone, they're like, oh yeah, I follow you on Twitter. And I'd get this immediate, like, oh, that feels weird. Just have, it still feels kind of weird, where it's like, meeting someone who knows you and you don't know them. It's just, yeah, this sort of feeling of like, oh, they have an idea of, they have an opinion on me already. And I was always, yes, like, well, it's probably bad. I don't like that. But, yeah, that was, it wasn't, it like got more and more prevalent over time at college, but it always was a thing that I was like, I don't know how to feel about this.
Well, it's just, that's, that person knows me and I don't know them. How do they know me? That is the root weirdness of fame.
Yeah.
That's like that, the, your personal relationship with fame is always based on strangers knowing you.
Mm-hmm.
And that, on a very basic human level, feels weird.
Especially because it's they know you in this conceit that you have created online, and it's oftentimes where it's like, that doesn't really represent a totality of my personality, and yeah, it is a very specific like facet of my personality that I think if I were to step out and just sort of like look at it, I think I'd be like, I don't know that I like that person. So then a lot of times I'm just sort of like, oh God, I hate that they know that of me and don't get to experience me as a person just regularly.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, it's an interesting experience to get, you know, when you're still in college. I mean,
yeah,
you know, I remember shortly after I got on the Conan show back in the 90s, I went back to Chicago to visit my family, and I went to a store with my mom. And when we left, my mom was like, did you notice that all, it was a Best Buy, I think, there were like three employees following you around? And I was like, no, I didn't. And she said, yeah, like everybody in the store was staring at you. Like, and she was all excited. And I was like, oh, mom, wow, think about that statement. Everyone was staring at you. Like, even though I know why they're staring at me, you can't get over the basic fact of just feeling stared at.
Yeah.
Like, no one, you know, I shouldn't say no one. Most people, some people love being stared at. I'm not one of them. And it just, it's not a natural kind of feeling. Yeah.
There are times where I feel like I'm being stared at or watched. And it always is this thing of like, is it because they recognize me, or is it because I am like weird, or like something else that it's like I should be cognizant of? And I'm always like, it's never comforting. It's never. And I also am like, well, I'm not famous, really. I'm not known enough that like I should be like, oh, there's another person staring at me. So I'm just like, it just makes me feel bad and weird. And I'm like,
yeah, yeah.
If it is someone that knows me, I'm like, just come up to me and say, I know you, and walk away or something.
Right, 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 right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I start thinking about like, there are times where someone does eventually come up to me and I immediately am just like, how long have they seen me? Did I do anything weird in that time?
Yeah.
But yeah.
was I compulsively pulling at my crotch?
Oh no. Was I air drumming? Did they watch me air drum an entire song?
No nose picking. Well, when you're done with college, I mean, you come to LA, right? I mean, was that pretty fast?
So my college has this program where they, for your last semester of school, you can go out to Los Angeles and do like an internship and take classes at like a remote center in LA. And I took that advantage of that program. So I moved out to LA with like 20 other students from UT. So it was a very easy transition to just be like, oh, I still know people, and like we have friends that are all like interested in the same thing. And a lot of us live together, and it was very easy in that. And then I also was like, okay, well, I am still also in LA now. And I'm like, I had an internship at Red Hour, which is Ben Stiller's production company. And so it was like, I got to work in comedy and got to surround myself with people in comedy who pretty quickly learned that I was doing things online and were like, oh, okay, this guy knows and is interested in comedy. He's someone that we should stay in touch with, which was always nice.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a pretty easy transition.
Was the internship set up through school?
No, it was like I had to go and find the internship.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
And was that, was it classified ads?
I think it was like there was a website online where it was just like entertainmentcareers.net or something. And I just was like,
oh, I see.
Just shotgun approach. Like I got to write a thing and send it to all of these places. Yeah. So it's like I applied to 100 different internships and like there were so many ones where it's like I get a response and I got so excited. Just be like, oh, my God, I'm going to intern for Jason Reitman. Oh, my God, I'm going to intern for all of these places. And it was like I got very lucky with Red Hour and just was like as soon as they were like, well, we can offer you an internship. I was like, yeah, no, I'm not going to get better than this. Yes, let's do it.
Yes. And that's Ben Stiller's company for people that don't know. That's,
yeah.
Yeah.
And
so you became best friends with Ben Stiller right away.
Inseparable. I was like, buddy, you gotta do a movie where you play a fake war, a fake soldier. It was my idea. Tropic Thunder was me. No. but it was truly so great, and like it was such a small team that I felt immediately like, oh, I'm gonna get to know all of these people.
Yeah.
And it was. Yeah, I still am in touch with a few of them, and it's very nice. And at the time, it was really just me, like, doing, like, readings of scripts and being like, here's my coverage on this script, or just sort of, like, surfing the net for things that they needed, or, like, going on supply runs. Every so often, I'd get to, like, be on set for, like, a web series they were doing, and I'd be like, this is where it is. This is where the juice, this is what I want to be doing, baby. But it was fun.
They never did. Were they working on any features while you were there? Or?
I think they had just finished up Walter Mitty, and like it hadn't premiered, but it was like they were doing all the marketing and stuff for that.
But so would you? Was, but I mean, would you have gotten to work on movies like on set on those, or probably not?
I can't imagine. Although there was, I do remember there was one. I don't remember what we were doing, but there was something that Ben Stiller had to do on a like I want to say the Universal lot. And they needed me to go and deliver things to him. And I was just, they were like, yeah, you're just going to have to hang around for a bit during the day. And I was like, oh, so they're shooting something on this lot and they need me to stick around to essentially be like an assistant of sorts. But I was like, oh, God, I wish that it was a movie they were filming, because then I would at least get to be on the set and just watch them like shoot this movie. But I don't think it was. I think it was like a series of interviews or something. I don't even know.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So when that's done, I mean, are your folks okay with you moving to LA? Are they, you know?
They were stressed about it, but at least while I was doing it through school, it was the kind of thing where they were like, well, this is still school, so it's not that bad. But shortly after it was when they got really worried, because I didn't have a job in LA for the first 4 months that I was there, and I was just like crashing on friends' couches. And
this is after the internship program. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And at a certain point, they were like, just come home and do interviews from home. And I had an interview for, I think it was like to work on the like video editing team for like NFL programming. And I had a phone interview with them, and they were like, cool, can you come in tomorrow? And I was like, I'm in Plano, Texas. I can't. They were like, oh, well, that's a shame. Sorry. And I was like, okay, I need to go back out to LA because I can't do interviews from Plano, from my bedroom at home. And so they were like, okay, yeah, go back out there. But then again, it was like the 4 months of me just being around. And I was like, that's when I had always really liked like visual effects and like typography and just like motion graphics and stuff. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to make a reel of me having done that stuff in the past and my ability to do that stuff. And maybe I'll get like a job at a VFX house or like some production studio, just being able to do like
typography for them or whatnot, and that'll be like a foot in the door. And I did that for 4 months, just like going out for interviews, being like, I want to do VFX stuff. I really like VFX. Let me work in that field. But eventually the job that I got was as an office manager at this animation studio, ADHD, which doesn't exist anymore, but it was like an animation studio that did a bunch of cartoons for Fox, like Lucas Bros Moving Co. and Axe Cop, I think they did. And I was just like the guy who got snacks and like set up computers and like offices for people and was just like supposed to know everyone and just be the like overseer of the building, which was a weird first job for me. But it was like, I was like, I'm around animators and like there are writers that work here and that's good enough for me.
Yeah. And how long did that take? How long was that?
I was there for 6 months.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then what happens to have you move on?
So after that, the people that I had met while working at Red Hour went over to Funny or Die. And Funny or Die was putting together a digital team for their TV show At Midnight. And they were like, we know that you do video stuff and like are like very knowledgeable and popular online. Would you be interested in coming to do like Vines and media stuff for us over at Midnight? And I was like, oh, hell yeah, absolutely. But they also didn't have like a very like concise idea of what they wanted to do. So I got there and it was like a team of four of us. And they were just like, oh, we got two guys who are very good at visual effects and 3D. We got one animator and we got you, the like social media video writing guy. And they were just sort of like, I don't know, we'll figure out what you guys do eventually. But just if you have any ideas for content we can put online, make it. And so we were just like, it was just like a year of us just sort of being like, we have an idea for a video, let's do that. Or like, oh, we have an idea for a Vine, let's do that. Or we have this thing that requires Chris Hardwick to come into our office and like do something with us real quick, let's do that. And it was just like very unstructured, but in a way that worked so well for us. And like we were just like, it's just us getting to fuck around and make cool things. And that was a very fun place to be. It was just a playground. And
that is an amazing opportunity to be as young as you were and as new to this, to get to be able, because you don't get to say, you don't get creative say for a long time usually.
No.
In this business. I mean, and I was always, you know, even when I started out in doing commercial, you know, working on commercials back in Chicago, I always noticed like the people that got creative say were like the ad agency people. And obviously if you're like, you're doing a Wheaties ad, the Wheaties people get to say,
right.
It was the agency people and like the director. And that, you know, we're all in film school thinking like, we're all artists. We're all going to get, you know, personal expression. It's like, no, you'll probably, odds are just in the numbers game, odds are you'll be a script supervisor and you'll keep track of the script and that'll, you know, that's a good job and you're good at it, you get good at it. But creative say is a very minimal thing. So for you to, absolutely, you know, yeah, for you to get to do that. And there again, I think that's thanks to, you know, people, they obviously saw your work, you know, you had a reel online that is easily perusable, you know?
Totally. And I think it also helped that they were just sort of like, we need to be on social media, but we don't really know in what capacity or like what things to do. So we're just going to hire people who can do a lot of different things and then let them go, well, what do you guys see on social media that you want to do?
Yeah.
And we got lucky because we would just be like, oh, we should do something about this thing that's in the news or about this thing that happened on the show. And we would just like go for it. And we were very like adept and able to do things quickly. So we would just kind of be like, here's a video based on this thing that happened in the news this morning. Here's this video that happened based on this thing that happened on the show. And it was just like, we were able to call in like people from all over the office to work with us. And it was just sort of like, it was like, we have an idea and we'd send it to them and be like, yeah, I guess that works. Go for it. And then we make it and we're like, okay, well you worked so hard on it. Yeah. Put it up online. And like, we just, it worked and we got lucky. We like the creative team won 2 Emmys from that digital pod and we were like, oh wow, this rules. Yeah. It was great.
Does that make you an Emmy winner?
Technically, but my name was never like, I didn't
get an Emmy. So for my resume, I'm gonna say I'm an Emmy
winner. Part of an Emmy winning team.
Exactly.
Yeah, you can say that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you work at Midnight or at Funny or Die? Like, were you?
It was at Midnight.
It was at Midnight. Okay.
Yeah, we were like right next to the stage.
Okay.
Yeah.
And yeah, because that's a very, you know, that again, that's sort of tailored to the bite-sized digital world. That show was so like just about like
so of the internet.
Yeah, and so of the internet, obviously, because it basically was the Twitter game show, you know, and it was like, I mean, having been on it, it was, you write tweets. They give you premises and you write tweets.
Totally.
Is this like, are you still able to keep up your own creativity on your own stuff, on your own vines and stuff? Or are you now using it all for work?
It felt like I was able to keep up my own creativity, which was very good. It felt almost like, weirdly, I was able to keep up my own creativity and supplement it with things from work. It was like, I think I was in a very particular, like a very specific place with At Midnight, where it was like, I was doing the things that probably needed the least amount of work in that pod of four of us. Cause it was like, animation takes a while. 3D and visual effects can take a while. But I was just like, if I had a video idea that we could shoot and we could like get a team together for it, it was like, cool, go off and shoot it. And if it takes forever, it takes forever. And if it doesn't take forever, it doesn't take forever. And in the meantime, it'd be like, I have ideas for things that I'd like to do. And I think I started getting back into a lot of musical stuff then, like tinkering around and being like, oh, mashups are fun, but I can't do mashups on At Midnight. I guess I can put these on my Twitter or something, or like figuring out other Vine ideas that were like, this won't work for At Midnight, but it is something that I want to do and my friends will help me do. So I'll just do it with them at the office and then post it on my own. Like, they were all happy to do that. We were all just like, we just love making these things. We're happy to make things. If you have an idea that you're like, yeah, I'm just going to do this for myself, they'd be like, yeah, all right, go for it. And it was great. As long as it isn't getting in the way of other people doing shit, then let's do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was I going to say? Oh, you go from sort of doing these, from doing videos into doing podcasts. Like, that you started to kind of do that transition. I also want to ask, is that how is working on At Midnight? Is that when you really sort of find a creative community here in LA? Were you able to do that before? I mean, because, you know, on this show, people always end up talking about kind of what, as I've ended up calling, finding your tribe, you know, like really finding your group of people that you can kind of blossom in. And I'm wondering if that happened at Midnight. I mean, how do you come from Texas and all of a sudden start having a bunch of cool creative friends? Because I want to know. I still don't have many. And
I think it's always hard. I think that At Midnight was definitely very helpful in doing that. But I think that the podcast thing started just before At Midnight, when I was still an office manager at ADHD. I had met someone who knew of me through Twitter and Vine. And I was going to UCB shows like all the time. It was like just the only thing that I did in my free time, just because I was like, I don't know too many people, but I want to be in comedy so bad, I'm going to go see other people do comedy. And there was one time I went to a show where my name was drawn for something, and someone called out Electro Lemon, or like they wooed when someone said Electro Lemon, and I was like, why does this person know who I am? And then after the show, they like hit me up. I'm like, oh, that was me. I know of you from Twitter and Vine. I think you're very funny. And so we became friends. And then at one point, he had posted on Facebook that he wanted to do a podcast about Gilmore Girls, since it was they were going to put all the old episodes up on Netflix. And I was like, that sounds fun, which is something that I just sort of did on a whim because I'd never seen Gilmore Girls. But I was just sort of like, I would totally watch that show and talk about it. And that was my friend Kevin T. Porter, who we truly didn't know each other very well before doing that podcast. But on a whim, we were just like, yeah, let's do the podcast. Let's see what that would be like. And our chemistry worked together very well. And we just got lucky because it was like, that was so much of my creative voice was just in doing that podcast. And it was like, I was able to talk with people that I would have never met otherwise. And I was able to have this sort of space where I was allowed to be comfortable and creative, but it was like reaching an audience of people that it's like, oh, nothing else I do has this level of an audience, because nothing else I do is founded on the back of this massively popular TV show that no one's talking about anymore. So it's just like tapping into an audience of people that aren't really, like, it's like just lying inactive almost. And yeah. So through that, I was able to sort of like develop my own creative voice, but also meet so many people and just go like, oh, I like this person. Oh, I like this person. Oh, I'd love to hang out with these people. And just figuring out what I was able, like what I liked doing, what I was able to do in a more concentrated manner. And then that plus At Midnight, I think made me go like, oh, I love creating things with these people. I want to create more things with these people. And it's just sort of like, I guess with the podcast, it was more taking a chance on a thing that I didn't know how it would be, but I got a vibe of like, I like working with this person, so let's just see what it's like to work with this person. And with At Midnight, it was just sort of like realizing that I worked well with these people and we had very similar tastes and could hang out in a way that didn't feel like work all the time. So I got lucky with that.
You started to do... Was it in Gilmore Guys that you started to do live versions of the podcast?
Yeah. We would do.
And you weren't a live performer up to that point, really.
Not at all. No.
What was that like? Was it terrifying to go do it the first time? Or
I think the weird thing about it is that I was never too terrified. And I think that's like I was never like a performer. I didn't do like theater or improv or any of those things. Like I was never like a stage person, but I felt like I was pretty comfortable on a stage. And I think it helps that when doing Gilmore Guys, it was always like performing for an audience that knows us and is just like sort of, it's like if you were to do improv, but like everyone there already loves you. And
yeah,
so
I get it. Yeah.
It's like, you can just be comfortable being yourself. And therefore it was like my first stage experiences were just being like, yeah, I can just be myself and you guys are already cool with that. And
right. Surrounded that by making. Love. Yeah. Exactly. You go out to it's not like you're doing stand up at an industrial job, you know, for all of the, you know, accountants at
totally.
And Verizon, it was also, or whatever.
It was also free form that like there was very little prep that I needed to do besides just watching the episode and just being like, okay, so I've seen the episode. I'm just going to say things that I would say anyway, but in front of people. So I get an immediate feedback of like, I liked what he said. And so it was just very easy to develop a voice of like, what do people like of me? And what am I good at doing when it's just like doing the thing that I already do? And I'm like, I'm comfortable with this, but then getting like the instant feedback of like, people laughed at that. Good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As that audience grows and as you're sort of, you know, and as you kind of, where do you think it's going for you at that time? Like, do you think like, I'm going to be a professional Gilmore Girls commentator for the rest of my life, or, you know?
No, that was actually one of the reasons that I was like, I think I need to get away from this, because I realized that like, as much as it was helping me connect to people that I really admired, and like, I don't think I would have gotten my writing job on The Good Place if I hadn't done Gilmore Guys. I do think that there was a point at which it was like, oh, this feels like it's just building in on itself. Yeah. Where it's like, there's a ceiling that I can hit with this podcast, and it's just like, it's always going to be, people want you to talk about different media, or like people want you to talk about Gilmore Girls specifically, or when I do other things, it's like people will just sort of try to tie that into Gilmore Girls or try to tie it into you commenting on media. And I was like, oh, I don't want to do that because I want to create media. And also I'm not super attached to Gilmore Girls. It's like, I like it, but I don't want my life to be it. And I don't want my life to be like, now he's talking about Buffy, or now he's talking about this other thing. So I was just sort of like, I think I'm going to step away from this and try to make my own things and try to figure out how to be creative and not just sort of like a commentator.
Yeah.
But I think that was hard for me at one point because it felt like my attitude around the podcast became negative just because I resented what it was doing in my life and just feeling like I don't want to be like, I don't want my only claim to fame to be people are like, you're the Gilmore Guys guy. And it's like, but I've been working on stuff for so long that's like just original and of my own self. It feels weird to like have this one thing come in and be like, forget everything you've ever done. You are now the guy who comments on other media. And I'm like, that sucks. I don't want that at all. So I think stepping back from it also made me go like, okay, I don't want to seem like I have a negative connotation of what I did because I liked doing the podcast. I did it for 3 years and I loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's a good instinct to have because, I mean, one of my grouchy old man complaints about a lot of what is current comedy is that it's exactly what you said. It's commentary on other things. It's not, you know, and I mean, and even I think sometimes, you know, fan culture, you know, can be – It's just distracting that everything has to be a reference to some other kind of totemic item of culture, you know, like I, when Stranger Things first came out and they all the talk was about, you know, that, you know, as if there were like Easter eggs throughout the whole thing of that shot's just like the shot from Poltergeist and that shot's just like the shot from, I don't know, fucking, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street. Yeah, or whatever. And I just was like, what about making new stuff? what about not having to put in and also something that takes you out of the actual experience of watching the show about this world and these characters because you always got to keep an eye out for when they're going to, you know, be ripping off Robert Zemeckis.
It's just making professional love letters, just being it's not really a story. It's just a love letter to this genre. It's like, okay, I like the thing too, but I don't want to watch someone else like it. It's
just a snake eating its own tail. It just, you know, it's like a navel gazing. It folds in on itself and in on itself and in on itself until it's not really anything. So, I mean, good for you is basically what I'm saying.
Thank you. And then I went on to make musical parodies.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Oh, shit. I take back everything I said. You're a hack. It's great. Because you had another podcast, too, then after that, didn't you?
I did a podcast after that called Punch Up the Jam, which was – it was half musical commentary, half writing songs. But
yeah.
You
punched up popular songs. You're like
– yes.
Yeah. Yeah, which is a very funny idea.
It was an idea that we both loved, and we knew it was going to be a lot of work, but I left because I was like, okay, it is a lot of work, but it's more than I thought it would be, and I can't do this every week and also do other things outside of this. But it was like, we were just like, what if we talk about popular songs and the lyrics within them and just sort of like get like very overly semantic about what they are. And then we were like, we fixed the song and just have like either a parody or like a quote unquote fix of the song that we like rewrote it or like made it different in some fun way. And that was a blast. And I think is like still a very good, it was a good mix of commentary and creation that I think was something that a lot of people wouldn't have done because it was a lot of work, but also it was just like a very good, just sort of like microcosm of all of my talents in a way that I was like, I get to do the things that I like to do, but I'm still in the field that people are like, oh, well, I like when he's the commentary guy.
Yeah. Did, at what point do you go to work for, The Good Place? Is that the first kind of narrative comedy that you worked on?
Yeah, totally. It was the reason I left At Midnight, actually. The first like writing job I ever got was I wrote for, I think, the 2015, that seems so long ago, 2015 like MTV Video Music Awards, and I was like, that was great. And it was like sort of just being in a writer's room like that was the instant gratification of being like, this is exactly what I want to do and what I think I'm good at doing. And then I got to meet writers for Parks and Rec through doing Gilmore Guys. And they had needed a new staff writer for the new show they were going to work on, The Good Place. And they put my name in the hat. And I met with Mike Schur and hit it off. And I had an interview on Monday. And on Wednesday, they were like, cool, can you come in next Monday. That's when the show starts. And it was like that weird thing that sometimes happens in LA where you're at a job and you just got to go like, so I need to leave this week. Sorry.
Yeah, I got a job. Yeah.
Yeah. I know I've been here for a year and you guys are genuinely like my family, but I'm gone. And yeah. It was like they all understood and they were like very happy for me. But it was just such a weird like transition. And also, I didn't know what the show was. I didn't like I was afraid to ask questions about the show in the interview. And it was like going so well. I was just like, I don't care. Like, it's Mike Schur. I'll do whatever he wants to make. And so like I like loosely looked up things and I was like, oh, it could be one of these two shows that is in the news. And the first day of the show, I was like, I still don't know what this is, but I'm going to work on a Mike Schur show with all these people that I admire. Let's do it. And it was like on that first day, they're like, all right, so here's what the show is. And I was like, oh, this is nuts.
Yeah. It is. It's like among the strangest, well, the most unique kind of concepts for a sitcom and like, I don't know.
Yeah. For like
maybe
a network
ever. Yeah.
TV show. It was very like, I instantly was like, this is so bold. I can't wait to see how this works. I was also like skeptical for a lot of it. I was just sort of like, I think a lot of this is going to get toned down by the network, but I'm doing my job, so let's go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you there for the full run of it?
I was only there for the first season.
Oh, for the first season. Yeah. And did you move on or did they, I mean, you know, it's an awkward question.
I mean, it was very much, they did not pick me up for the second season, which I don't blame. I was not great in that room. It was a lot of anxiety and a lot of like ADHD I didn't know how to deal with and just sort of like, me trying to, it was a hard room to have my first ever job in. But just
for what reason? Yeah.
Well, it's like, it was a lot of anxiety and it was like, it's like getting close to your dream job, but it's like diving to the deep end. It's being like, all right, here's a very tightly structured show that you have to figure out how to work in with all these people who have been doing this for years and have worked together. And it was like a lot of anxiety and it caused a lot of issues for me that I didn't fully understand and was just sort of like trying to ignore. And that was a stressor. And it was just like, I wasn't a good fit in the room. And it was more like, it felt a lot like I was on a ride along for a lot of it, just being like, oh, this is so cool. I'm so happy to be here. I don't know when to pop in and like suggest something or when to like be quiet or not.
Yeah.
And so it was just like, yeah. But
yeah, it might. I mean, there is something to getting a, you know, to learn the ins and outs of that kind of, because there is, you're absolutely right. There is like, you have to learn how to behave.
Yeah.
In a writer's room. And you have to learn the sense of whether you're talking too much, whether you're talking too little, like who you can talk over and who you can ignore and who you have to listen to. And that probably, you probably would have been better if you got on some sort of just like plain old sitcom, regular, you know.
Yeah.
You know, joke kind of thing. Because that is, yeah, that's a very unusual show, and you know, and a room full of heavy hitters too. It's got to be intimidating. Yeah.
But I still was like so happy to be there, and I'm like, God, I can't believe that I wrote on The Good Place. And it's still a thing that like people like, that's what people mention when like I have a meeting where it's like, you wrote on The Good Place, right? And it's like, yes, I did write on The Good Place.
Yes,
thank
yes,
you
yes.
for
weren't you part of an Emmy award winning team of animators?
Oh, yes, I was. Yes, that's so interesting you bring that up. Twice we won two Emmys, yeah.
was it tough when you – did you have a sense that you weren't going to get picked up or
– Oh, I knew. Or, I definitely knew. But it was like – it was the kind of thing where it's like, if I get picked up, I'm going into overdrive. I'm going to fucking figure out what's going on and like be better in that second season. But I knew I wasn't, and that was like a thing where I was like, this sucks and will crush me for a while. And still, I'm like, there are times where I'm like, I really fucked up in that room. But it's like, Mike Schur was so magnanimous about it and like gave me recommendations, when other shows approached him about me. And that was very nice. And then I got to work on, the next show I worked on was a show over at Marvel called New Warriors. Which was, it didn't end up going, but it was like a live action, like superhero series that was
superhero? Superheroes? That's rare.
Yeah, it was one of the first.
Wow, yeah. Superheroes. They should do more with superheroes.
That's what I said in the meeting. I was like, interesting. So they're people, but special. I get it. And they have problems like you or me.
Yes. And they wear pajamas?
And capes? Interesting.
But it was, yeah, I worked on that show for a year and we like wrote 10 episodes. I got to write 2 episodes. We shot a pilot that Disney was like, we love this. We can't wait to see it. And Freeform was like, we don't like it. And then they were like, well, don't worry. We'll put it on Disney Plus. And we were like, that's at least 2 years away. That means the show is essentially shelved.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was like, all right, well.
Well, and then you went on, you kind of like dipped into our little late night world with James Corden. You were there for a year, was it?
Yeah, I was there for a year. I left Corden almost a year ago exactly, actually.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was hired because of my musical online stuff, and I was like a good voice to do that on the show. But I think I kind of knew I wasn't a late night person. I don't think I'm great at writing to like someone else's specific voice. And I don't think that like, as much as like, it's like I can, it just feels like it's not the challenge or like thing that I really loved. Like I always loved narrative writing more than I liked joke writing. So I was just sort of like, I think I'm going to leave after about a year, but it was such a great show and everyone there is so awesome and I love them all, but it was like is this for me?
Yeah.
A lot of it.
Yeah. It can be, I can tell you, you know, as someone in their 50s and, you know, now I feel like I'm retired. Like me and my dog have just retired to a quiet life in a house, you know, somewhere.
Yeah. But,
there have been thoughts in the last few years of my life where I'll be in the middle of a rehearsal and I feel like I am 50 whatever years old and here I am thinking up bits. Like I'm sitting around here with other, you know, like grown adults who have children and mortgages and we're just trying to figure out like how to best, you know, finish up this bit about, you know, a rabid wolf that attacks a cake shop or whatever, right. You know, like, and it just, at times it does feel like, wow, this is really silly, silly stuff to be doing with your time.
I feel like everyone hits that sort of space or like hits that sort of mindset in comedy, though, where it's like, I think it just takes so much longer on a narrative thing because you don't feel like you're going, what are we doing here? Until you've like developed like a world. But with late night, it's like, well, here's the world. It's our world and go. And I think it's just like you get to a point where you're just kind of like doing a lot of the same thing a lot. And it just sort of feels like I'm already too much of a doing a lot of the same thing a lot person. So to go into a world where it's just that's how it works, I think was not the best thing for me to do.
But yeah.
It feels weird because it's like, I don't want to sound like I'm shitting on late night. I was just like I still think that Corden was such a great place. And like, I love the people who worked there. And there were times where I was like, I cannot believe I get to do this. Or I can't believe I get to make like Eric Idle sing this song that I wrote. But then at other times it's just sort of like, is this where I want to be? Like,
should I
be? Yeah.
Well, and you're young and, you know, and it's you do have so many options and it is, you know, you gotta, you know, when I first left the Conan Show back in 2000, it was exactly that. It was just that and at that point it had been 7 years and I just felt like I was doing the same thing. Now when you know, especially when you have children, doing the same thing becomes like oh, boo hoo, you got to do the same thing. Go make a check, you know, like you got to earn a living. But I still was, you know, young enough and childless enough that to be kind of like, I've got to see what else I can do, because it does get hard, you know, when you get used to kind of burning creative juices and, you know, and putting product out there of your own stuff and always, especially if you're somebody that wants to challenge yourself, it can get really stifling and you just need to kind of make that break and make that change. So did you have anything to leave to, or did you just?
No, I had been working. I had like had personal projects and things that I wanted to develop to develop outside of Corden that I was like, well, I'll get to do these. And I was dating someone who lived in New Zealand at the time. So I went and lived in New Zealand for 2 months.
Nice.
Which was exciting and terrifying, just because it's like, all right, you're the only person I know in this entire country. I'm going to spend a lot of time with you and no one else. And we were both like, oh, it's kind of like how a lot of relationships, I'm sure, are in quarantine right now. We're just like, do something else, do something with your time. So it was like, all right, I'm going to go for a walk in New Zealand. And it was all just like me trying to figure out what to do aside from like, there was a movie that I really wanted to write. And I was just like, I have to finish writing this movie. It's what I'm in New Zealand for, aside from spending time with Maddie. But I was like, I'm here to write this movie. I'm going to finish this movie. And I'm going to have a thing that I return to the U.S. with, being like, I've done this. And it took so long to do, but I eventually did finish the movie and went back to the U.S. And then I was like, all right, well, what do I do now? And I just before that, I had started doing this monthly show at Dynasty Typewriter called Everything's Great. That was just like a live comedy show. And that was my creative output for a lot of the time. Then I was just like, all right, I'm just going to figure out a new thing to do every month at the show. And so it was like, I'd write a new song, or I'd write a weird PowerPoint presentation bit, or like doing all of these things. But it was like, I was like, here's the thing I could do month to month. What am I doing for my future though? Like, and that's, I think, still kind of where I am.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it weird to you to have done all these, you know, and I'm making air quotes, like legit showbiz things, and that really probably the biggest impact you've made is with Vines and stuff online that's just kind of like, you know, free social media stuff? I mean, is that...
Totally.
Yeah.
It's very weird to me, and it feels like it feels like because of that I'm always fighting for legitimacy in my own eyes, but also in other people's eyes sometimes, because I'm always just sort of like... I think I also spread myself very thin in that I do a lot of things where it's like, I've done this, and I've done this, and I've done this, and I've done all of these things. And then when I meet with someone, I'm just sort of like, what are they meeting with me because of?
Yeah.
And if it's like, oh, we're meeting with you because we loved you on Vine, I'm like, Vine has been gone for like 7 years now. I've been doing a lot of other stuff, but okay. And it's always just sort of this thing where like, I'm like, oh, one day something's going to happen for me that feels notable. And people just go like, oh, the Vine guy got a TV show or whatever. And I'll just be like, that's going to feel crushing. Just being like, that's how people think of me in a certain way. But it also just feels like, even when I first got in a writer's room, I was like, I feel I'm going to have to fight for legitimacy here, because people just go like, he's not supposed to be here. He's like an internet. He's one of the kids who got popular because he was on Vine, and Vine isn't real comedy or whatever.
Right.
And it's
like you did makeup tutorials or something like, yeah.
Right. And I get that, because I think I also still mentally put a lot of people in that box of like, oh, they're like, oh, I'm a YouTuber. I'm like, oh, okay, I know what that means. And
right.
It's like, no, a lot of people, like a lot of good work goes into YouTube stuff, and it's like all legitimate. Like, but in my head, I'm like, but it's a platform that I did not grow up with as a legitimate thing. So therefore I'm like, well, I don't care about it. Therefore it's not real.
Yeah.
But it is a weird thing to sort of, but I also think I have a very weird relationship to the things that I've done as a whole, where it's like everything I'm a very much like a, I did this thing, time to move on kind of person. And I'm always like in pursuit of like, I just want to write and like direct. I just want to make things. And because of that, it's like, well, I haven't gotten a chance to do that. So everything I've done in the past is just like nothing. And therefore it'll be like, people really love this one thing you did. And I'm like, oh, they're going to think of me as that guy. I don't want that. I want to be a writer. And it's like, I have a very contentious relationship with my own work, despite it being like, well, people like that work. It's like, yeah, but it's not what I want to do. So I'm mad about it. And it's like,
I know. Yeah. I would tell you as an old person, cause I can relate. And I think I have whatever that disease is that I completely discount and write off anything that I'm good at easily.
Sure.
You know, so it's like if I, you know, people,
you know, they complement different things that I do well that I just have always been able to do well and that don't take a lot of work. And I'm like, yeah, well, fuck that. That doesn't.
Right.
And I think, too, I tend to look back on a lot of the things that I did and think, well, yeah, but I mean, not a lot of thought went into it. It was just a goof and it just kind of, you know, was like this or, you know, I feel conflicted about that because that one thing I worked on that people are complimenting me on, I didn't have a good time on it. And it's all like, it's a, and I understand how that can be an engine, a creative engine to somebody who is starting out and challenging themselves to do, and I mean, not starting out, but a person that isn't like, you know, that still is trying to find their voice.
Yeah.
And I, you know, and it's ironic to me to say that because in ways I feel like I'm still trying to find my voice. Like the notion of like, what do I want to say with what I do? I don't fucking know yet. And I'm still, you know, as old as I am, but I do know, and I work hard now trying to be a little bit nicer about the things that I've done in the past, like to myself, like be a little bit more like it's a huge, huge thing to me that the Conan show means to young comedy people, what other, like what David Letterman meant to me, you know, and that there are people that will say to me, you and Conan helped form my sense of humor and they're now doing comedy professionally. And that's a really, I mean, I can't even imagine anything kind of more soul enriching that I could have done with this silliness.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, but I mean, because, and also, also your stuff is fucking hilarious. It's really clever. And I in preparation for this, to go to your website, which is just demiadijuibe.com, right?
I think it's demiadijuibe.be, as if you were spelling my name and then the period is, I don't know.
Oh, okay. At any rate, it's, well, the link to it is on Wikipedia. It's got all your bits. Mm-hmm. And if you just, if you listener out there want to just enjoy yourself for, I mean, shit, you could spend a long time on there just looking at these great bits. It's incredibly funny, inventive stuff, not only musically, but cinematographically, you know, cinematography wise, great camera tricks, really great stuff, really fun stuff that you should be very proud of. And that, you know, I mean, if I had more power, I'd just give you a job doing something just based on that, you know. What's the biggest one you ever did, you think? Like
the biggest video?
Yeah, like video or like thing that you did. I think the first thing I ever knew, you came to my attention by the thing where you left DVDs of Click in your folks' house.
Yeah.
Which that was the funniest fucking thing ever.
Which is so funny because it was genuinely an accident from a video that I made a Vine where it was just like me dancing to the song Click by Kanye. And then I say, why do I have 57 DVDs of Click? Which is just the amount of DVDs that would fit on that shelf.
Right.
And
they were fake. Like they were like just color copied fakes or did you?
Yeah, buy? they were literally just like I printed out the label and then put them in the DVD covers for the Vine. And the Vine was like, whatever. People were like, oh, that's so funny. And then I just went away and I went, I think I went back to college for the school year and then I came back in November and they were all still there. And I was like, my parents haven't mentioned this once. Have they seen it? And then I took a photo and I was like, I literally just said the truth. It's like I left these DVDs here and they have not mentioned a single thing about it. And
Are they still there?
No, I removed them at one point. And also, there was a point at which my sister saw that the tweet was popular and then like told my parents and they were like, oh, yeah, we saw that. We didn't know what that was about. So I was just like, oh.
But what difference does it make?
Yeah. And they were just like, well, not going to mention it. Huh, strange. I think they got very used to just being like, Demi's doing something. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, now, I didn't let you finish. What do you think you're sort of like?
I think the September videos are the thing that people are like, that's what Demi does every year that I gotta know. But then it's also like, I do a lot of the songs that I'll, like the end credit raps I really like still and people think they're great. I think just the conceit that I came up with for them, just like shooting them as if it's like a thing I stumbled across is something that makes it very fun for me.
Yeah.
But those are pretty well liked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what are you going to do when this is all over? I don't mean this podcast. I mean, you know, being able to leave the house, you know, that kind of.
Well, I got
to
walk my dog. I got to nap again. I don't know. I really like before this quarantine, even I was just sort of like, I get very paralyzed by the idea of making things myself. But then it's like, I'll make like videos and all of these the things that I make online are ideas that I have a million ideas, and these are the ones that I can do on my own, and these are the ones that I can do without the help of other people, because I'm always just sort of like, I don't know where to start when I'm working with other people. I don't know how to put a crew together to make the things that I want to make, or it's like too high concept and I'm like, okay, well, this takes a lot of work. I'll just wait for someone to be like, we want to give you $1 million, go. But I'm also like, I have so many things that it's like I just wrote this movie that I want to make, but I'm like, I'm going to end up having to sell a script because no one will let me direct it. So I just need to get some directing experience that I can be like, here's proof that I can do this shit. And I was like, I want to make a short film, or I want to make a direct music videos for someone. And so I'm like, I need to focus on that being the next thing that I do concretely.
Yeah.
That is like work for myself, because it's like, that's where I want to be. And I can't just wait and hope that someone goes like, do you want to do this? So it's like, I think that's the next thing for me. Either figuring out a short film that I would love to make that feels like it's within my voice and isn't just sort of like a, here's something.
Yeah.
Or just figuring out someone who makes music that would love for me to make a video for them, and like planning that throughout the quarantine. And then when quarantine ends, being like, cool, let's shoot this thing.
Yeah.
Or figuring out how to shoot it within quarantine. I don't know.
So, yeah, I mean, I kind of am like, I feel like the universe is put on pause, and I find myself thinking like, well, what happens at the other end of this? And I mean, I don't mean with the world. I mean, what do I do? Like, and the notion too, you know, so hunkered down here, and I'm thinking like, where's the big creative output that I should have? So I have all these things ready to go when I'm out of this, and
yeah,
that's not happening. 'Cause I'm not even, you know,
it's hard to think that way, because it's just sort of like you don't have an end date for when this is going to be. So it's like, what, you just keep making things? You're just supposed to have like a ton of shit ready to go?
Yeah.
I've been like doing little things here and there, and it's like every like 3 weeks I'll just be like, I'm going to pick up this new thing. And it was like, I did violin, and then I was sewing masks, and then I started painting, and now I'm baking a lot. And I'm just sort of like, I need to channel this all into one thing that I will be able to like work with after this is all done.
Yeah. But like a screenplay. Like that's, I'm always like, where's the screenplay? And then I'm like, well, I could also like slow braise some veal chops, you know? Like,
One's more immediately satisfying.
Yes.
And one is supposed to be satisfying in the long run. I finished a screenplay at the beginning of this, and I'm just sort of like, I shouldn't have to do more. That should be it. But it's like, no, you gotta keep going, and maybe you should try to get in a writer's room again. I'm like, but I'll bake instead. I'll paint.
Yeah, it's rough. Yeah. So
it is very much so.
Well, do you, we're getting to the end of this. And the final question, I mean, because you kind of got the first two, is the what have you learned part? I mean, what, you know, I think, you know, you're still kind of in the middle of a career here, and you're kind of known, but, you know, not maybe to a wider audience. And I'm wondering, do you think about like what you've done so far, what someone else might be able to learn from the path that you've taken?
Hmm. I think what I've learned so far is that, at least in terms of like what people have considered successes of mine, I think they all come from this place of me just going like, that's funny. Why not do it? And it's like, it's just this sort of thing of like not letting yourself go, oh, I don't know if that's good. It's like, just do the thing. And I think a lot of times people talk as if it's like, oh, he's so good at so many things. And it's like, I've done a lot of things that are trash and just get like fallen by the wayside, because it's like, you just do more things until people are like, well, that's good. And that's good. And these are the things that we know him for. And it's like, if you were looking at a catalog of everything I've done, you'd definitely go like, these things suck. But it's like, yeah, they suck, but I still did them, because it's like, you can't, like, no one's going to hit 100%. You just have to do the things. And whether that's like, you got to find what's either easy for you to do, or you got to find what is the most interesting for you to do. Like, what can like be carried by the weight of you wanting to do it more and just do it. And like some of those things will be hard because it'll be like, I don't know how to do it, or it's quarantine and I can't do that right now. But then it's like, you got to figure out what you can do and the way to do those things. And like, just to keep making things that maybe aren't what you want to do, but help you get to a place where people know who you are. So they'll help you do what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And also just, it's so helpful to have creative partners.
Yeah.
I think is something that I always,
it sure is.
It's like something that I still am like afraid to do at times, because I think I am very much someone who gets tired of things very easily. And then it's like, I will quit a project and it feels like I'm leaving my partner out to like high and dry. But it's also just like, I wouldn't have done it without having a partner in the first place. So yeah, it's like very good to have someone else that you can work with and that you feel accountable with and for.
Yeah.
And like, I just watched a movie yesterday where it was like about these two writers that work together. And I was like, oh God, wouldn't that be great? Just writing with someone and being like, I have to do this thing because my partner's right there. And it's like, yeah, I'd probably get so much more done if I just had someone that it's like, we have to do this, because if I don't, I'm not fucking myself over. I'm fucking over this person.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's, yeah, that kind of codependent relationship is like why I've had a trainer for the gym for the last 7,000 years. Cause
yeah,
to go to the gym by myself, but to like, oh no, there's somebody waiting there. I need to go because somebody's there, you know?
Yeah.
And I agree. One thing I've noticed going through my life and career is that every amazingly funny single person that I know has had almost always either somebody or a series of somebodies,
yeah,
that were there facilitating that and helping them to do that and helping them figure out who they are and giving them kind of space to be who they are. And then, right, and vice versa, you know, I think, you know, so yeah, that, but then the problem is finding that partner. It's almost like it's a marriage. It's like, you got to really, totally, be able to not get sick of that person, you know, and
you got to be willing to like give them control and feel like,
yes,
you trust them, which, yeah, I think is that's where it's funny, because as much as I'm down on myself, one of the reasons that I'm always like, oh, it's hard for me to find a creative partner is because it's like, I believe in myself a lot more than I believe in a lot of other people.
When, yes, it comes to creating, I know, things, exactly. Like,
yeah. I can't relinquish control to you because I know how to do it. Let me just,
yeah,
do it.
Yeah. 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 So I have a terrible self-image, but I'm also like a grandiose egomaniac.
Yes.
You know what, exactly, I mean? Like, no one's better than me and I need help. You know,
which is how we get in this industry.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, I think this notion, then, you've said it 1,000 times, making things, making things, making things. And that is like such a pure place to be coming from. Not that you need my congratulations, but I think that that's such a great motivator. And I think that it's a key to why your stuff is so good, at least the why, you know, things that I like about it, because it is about the joy of creation and about needing to just be doing something. And that's really admirable and really amazing. And I thank you so much for spending your time here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sure, sure. And, you know, hopefully we'll see each other somewhere in real life.
Yeah, if they ever let us out of our houses.
Yeah, before we both go gray. So, all right. You can see Demi anywhere, basically.
I'm everywhere.
Adejuwebe, Demi Adejuwebe. And again, check his website out. And that's it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And we will see all of you next time on The Three Questions. Thanks. I've got a big, big love
for you. The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It's produced by me, Kevin Bartelt, executive produced by Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Chris Bannon and Colin Anderson at Earwolf. Our supervising producer is Aaron Blair, associate produced by Jen Samples and Galit Sahayak, and engineered by Will Beckton. And if you haven't already, make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.